And so you're going to have some patients that are very focused on avoiding procedures and others that are very excited to get the most aggressive or most newest sounding thing, right? And so the difference creates some challenge for many of the patients in terms of really being comfortable with being randomized. In this study, this is not a study being done for device or drug approval, and so participants can get the treatment off study. And that creates another challenge, because some people come in and they come in wanting a stent, for example, and being able to convince them to be randomized in a study, they may or may not be comfortable with that based on what they've heard before they get to you. The third thing is that endovascular studies have a lot of exclusions, just because it's a procedural-based treatment. We know that there are challenges in provider equipoise, and you know, you're all in this room, and so we know that you're willing to take on the posture of equipoise because we realize there are major questions out there, but how you communicate that is always challenging. And then finally, they're outpatients, so they're harder to access. It's very important on the PIs, I think, to really adopt and convey a pro-enrollment mindset. And a lot of that is first being open and realizing that it's not just about the disease, but it's also about what are best practices for how you go about recruiting people in clinical studies in general. And then also understanding the different stakeholders that are involved and thinking about the value proposition of the study. Not from the standpoint of, well, I would like this hematologist to refer me patients, but to ask yourself, why would a hematologist want to refer me patients? Why would a participant want to be in the study? What do they get out of it? And I think once you start to understand these things, then I think it makes it easier to approach patients and to approach your colleagues in a more effective way. I think, again, as we've said already, being a hands-on PI is so important here, you know, really being actively involved in pushing forward the study despite our busy clinical lives. Dr. Kieran, who's not here, has consistently, over a long period of collaboration, 15 years now, I think, emphasized to us so many times, studies need to be made clinically friendly. In other words, the idea that the world will adapt to your study, really, to some extent, the study needs to adapt to the real world. And so when you implement it at your local sites, most importantly, considering the daily lives of your patients is very important to make the study easy for them. How can you consolidate clinical visits with whatever's being done in the study? How can you help them? If you're going to recommend an imaging assessment to look for iliac vein obstruction, you can say, well, okay, we're going to schedule your CT goodbye, or you can help them get it done sooner in a way that's convenient for them, steward them and help them on their way to that scan, et cetera, et cetera. As you gain experience in finding different ways to more effectively interact with patients, when new patients come in, you can convey to them what it is that you're doing for other patients. And that can also make the study more attractive. And then you also have to consider your colleagues, right? You have to remember the people that work in a hospital, they're there to take care of patients, not necessarily to do research. That isn't their job description, right? Even though they sort of try and help. They're very busy people. So when you interact with their ultrasound lab and you ask them for help, make sure that what you're asking them to do doesn't impair or impede their workflow. If you're asking a hematology clinic to help you, be a good partner to them. Communicate with them. Share information on the study with them. And be responsive to questions that they may ask you. The teamwork between an investigator and a coordinator is absolutely crucial. And you know, the regular meetings, the sense that there's open communication and that there's responsiveness when concerns are raised. This is so important, you know, in the actual doing of the study within a particular clinical center. And the centers that tend to enroll better and to be more effective in regulatory compliance as well tend to be sites where there is that close partnership. In terms of participant recruitment, you know, we think about it in a very systematized and organized way, and I encourage you to do as well. There are different phases and challenges, and different sites will have different challenges even in the spectrum here. There's participant identification, and that has to do with understanding where patients naturally go and finding ways to intersperse the study process into that process. Raising external awareness, of course. Informatics tools can be very helpful to this process as well. And also figuring out where the most important networks are located, right? With post-thrombotic syndrome, usually in most centers, there's about two benign hematologists that may see the largest share of those patients. And figuring out who those people are and gaining their buy-in and support is very, very important. Eligibility determination, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but the bottom line is that continually reviewing what you're doing to make sure that you really are identifying the right patients and taking an inclusive posture are also very important. And then, of course, obtaining consent, we'll talk a bit about that in future talks, and then dealing with other miscellaneous issues, cost and travel and other things like that. This focus right now on eligibility determination, again, the most important things are having clear criteria, taking an inclusive posture, and what I mean by that is that remembering that the trial results will be applied in the real world, and so there's no such thing as a perfect patient. When we talk about, oh, this person will be the perfect patient, we usually mean that they're socioeconomically well situated, they're tightly compliant with all the medications, they're going to show up for every visit. But let's remember that that isn't representative necessarily of the overall population of people in whom we might use this treatment, this interventional strategy in the future. And so we need to be thinking about being very broad and not applying our own exclusion criteria, not saying, well, okay, this patient lives an hour from the clinical center, there's no way I can ask them to come and show up. Well, you know what? This should be presented to the patient. You should be honest about what the study will require of them. But ultimately, it is the patient's choice. Similarly, economic issues, right? It's important to be honest with what you know about the treatments and about their insurance coverage and things like that, but it shouldn't be you that decides they're not in. It should be the participant that makes that choice as to whether or not they choose to be in the study or not. And then finally, monitoring is the most important thing here. Regularly reviewing what you're doing, having a second person take a look at who you excluded. I think that the PIs should probably review who's being excluded just to be sure that things are well understood. There are definitely, post-thrombotic syndrome is not necessarily a diagnosis that is so crisply clear cut in a medical record, right? It's not, those terms may not even be used in the medical record, right? So really understanding what we really, including all the people we could, is very important. Now, okay, the quizzes. Now I'm going to ask each of the lead sites that was awarded earlier with attention to comment. Dr. Marston, you run that list. First question, which of the following should exclude a patient from the CTRAC study? Bilateral, history of bilateral DVT with bilateral post-thrombotic syndrome, occlusion of the inferior vena cava, occlusion or 50% stenosis of a caval filter, congenital interruption of the IVC, or none of the above?
None of the above.
Oh, very good. Dr. Marston is showing why it is that this team is well. Correct. So again, remember in the updated protocol, there's nothing that can happen in an IVC except for acute thrombosis, right? Recent acute thrombosis. That would exclude a patient from the trial. Okay? So all those issues with filters, this, that, whatever, we've taken them out. And remember, we treat these people in real-world clinical practice. There's no real reason they shouldn't be in this study. Okay, I'm trying to remember who else was on the list here. Kush! Okay. How long is the required run-in period prior to final consent? At least 3 weeks? No more than 7 days? At least 7 days. No more than 3 months, or none of the above?
None of the above.
Oh, now you see the quality here. So the run-in period is gone, everyone. We killed it. Some of us suspected always that we would kill it, and we eventually killed it. It was a good idea, sort of, but it didn't really enable us to get people in this site in an efficient way. And in particular, it wasn't so much just the fact that people had to wait a short time. I think that when you have a period like that, it takes away the sense of urgency in enrolling. You know, it's sort of like, yeah, well, we'll do his imaging in 4 weeks, and we got the run-in period anyway, and we'll wait. And that sense of urgency, it was hard to feel that was always there, you know. And I think that having it gone, it's a nice addition by subtraction. Okay, Dr. Bashir, I think you were on that list too, right? Okay, which of these patients does not meet, and you know, if you get it wrong, we're gonna assume that it's really your coordinator that's driving success at your site, it's not you. Yeah. But which of these patients does not meet the CTRAC inclusion criteria, okay? They have a CT venogram showing 51% iliac vein area stenosis. We have an MR venogram showing 50% iliac vein area stenosis. We've got a duplex ultrasound showing total iliac vein occlusion. We've got intravascular ultrasound showing a 50% iliac vein diameter stenosis. Or we have a catheter venogram showing a 50% iliac vein diameter stenosis. Which one of these patients doesn't meet the CTRAC inclusion? So it is Jenny. It's Jenny that's good. What's that? Okay, so this question gets us to a few separate issues, right? That are a little bit thorny to think through. First of all, it's greater than or equal to 50%, okay? It is okay. So if you're at 50%, you got it. It can be either the area or the diameter. In the first protocol, I think we said diameter and then we axed it. For the reason that I think people, you know, obviously you can measure the diameter differently. Some people are using, many people use IVUS and all that, and so it can be area or diameter. We've deliberately left it broad to give you the best chance of enrolling people. And then in terms of the allowed modalities, it's gotta be one of the cross-sectional modalities or IVUS or catheter venogram. Duplex ultrasound by itself is not allowed to, you can't enroll somebody based on a duplex ultrasound. If you have plethysmography showing venous obstruction, along with a duplex ultrasound showing that the iliac vein is involved and showing that the respiratory physicity is asymmetrical, then you can go ahead and use that. Very few sites, I think, are actually using the PLETH pathway. But this one had a number of different thorny elements in it.
Sir, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So that technician, cross-sectional view of 50%, area stenosis about only 30% diameter stenosis. That patient is enrolled in the study?
You know, if you have a 30% diameter narrowing, you cannot enroll a patient.
But I mean, that is going to be equal to about 50 area stenosis wise, right? If you...
No, 50% area is about a 30% diameter.
Yeah.
But if you have 50% area, you can enroll.
But
you have to document the area. So I see what you're saying, but I think that you need to be able to document the area. That's a great point. You need to be able to document that the area was narrow or document that there's a stenosis. I mean, if you're audited, for example, by the FDA, right? You know, they were very insistent when we pursued the PLETH pathway. They hated it. The FDA just hated it, you know, and their concern was that you're going to enroll people. We explained that, look, plethysmography is actually more physiological than just looking at the narrowing in the vein, right? But they had already been sold on the idea that a 50% narrowing is some big magical thing, right? And in particular, they were very clear on the fact that they really don't want people with less than 50% narrowing being stented. You know, they didn't want them exposed to the risks of stents. So you need to be able to document it, that's the key. So if you can find one place on that CAT scan, right, where the diameter is narrow, document that. If you find one place on the IVUS where the area is narrow, document that, you know.
And that includes external and common iliac or common iliac?
Anywhere in the iliac vein. Yep. So if you have, it could be a stenosis or it could be a long term. Yes.
Question. So with the new protocol, most of the time we get pre-operative or pre-procedural imaging, but if we have somebody where it's borderline or not sure, we do the venogram and they do have 50%, do you have the ability to randomize on the table so they won't get the venogram?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's very difficult, you know, because, you know, the patient, you can't really offer the patient inclusion, you know, until they meet the criteria. Yeah, and so practically speaking, I would say no. And then you've also got the issues of sedation. You know, you can't really, you know, you have to kind of, that would involve consenting them before, right? But the problem, though, is that they don't really have the diagnosis until they've got it, you know. Now, one thing that we are encouraging is using venoms and IVUS. If you take the posture of equipoise, right, if you, what you're saying is that even if you have an iliac vein abnormality, we don't know what the right treatment is, which is the posture we're taking for this study. It's not unreasonable, okay, to do a diagnostic venogram with IVUS, which is what we do in some of our patients, you know? Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily appropriate for every patient. There are some people who are like, you know, I don't want two procedures. I'm not advising you to do that in people who are not comfortable with it. But we are doing it, and I find it's a lot better because, quite honestly, my personal opinion, CT, very hard to get good CTs. I mean, I'm in a great imaging institution, and trying to get great CTs has been just impossible, really. And in my clinical practice, I really rely mainly on IVUS, frankly, to either make or exclude. And in a patient with C4 or above disease or with moderate or severe post-thrombotic syndrome, if I come up with a negative on the CT scan, I'm probably going to do that IVUS, you know? And if I come up with a positive on the CT scan, I'm going to do that IVUS. So, you know, to me, I prefer to make the diagnosis that way. And I would encourage that. And I think you'll get the most accurate sense of whether or not the patient really has the problem, you know, by doing it that way, you know. Tony, do you have a comment?
I think the biggest question most people have, and not only for this trial, but in general, is what the comment before about the 50% area being a 30% diameter sclerosis. And these are supposed to be advanced patients, CVI patients, with post-thrombotic. And if you're going to have a post-thrombotic lesion, it's not going to be a compressive iliac lesion.
Yeah, that's right. And I agree that there will be some people, and I know because I've been through the process of looking at a CT scan, knowing the history and the whole story, you know they've got it, okay? And then you go look at the CT scan, and it's clearly a narrow iliac vein, but can I find one single place where it's 50% compared to the other side? I mean, a long segment, 40%, is a pretty narrow vein, really, in terms of flow, right? And I've been stuck a little bit, right? But that's why I kind of, you know, overall, I think that doing more IVUS is going to be the solution, frankly, here, you know? Yeah.
And one more question to the high enrollers. What percentage of the patients that you're enrolling have post-thrombotic iliac disease, like extensive, versus a compression site that has post-thrombotic, let's say, an ephemeral popliteal segment from a previous DVT, and you find that they have just an iliac compression?
So all of my patients that I've enrolled, all the patients that I've enrolled for long segment occlusions, so it's not even a stenosis really. But if you do an ascending diagram for fundum up, all you see is collaterals. You don't
review, I expect that answer. No. That's the biggest challenge.
The biggest exclusion for us have been patients that don't have severe enough BCSS. So if they have that low grade, you gotta be honest about assessing the severity of their symptoms.
Yeah, that's right.
Anybody else? Because I think based on the protocol, you can include a lot of the patients that have femoral popliteal disease, and the iliacs never were thrombosed, but they just have a 50% area reduction.
That's correct. As long as there's good inflow to the common femoral vein, right? So in other words, there's a difference between having bad disease at the top, where you don't get good inflow, versus having some short segment of abnormality down in the popliteal or something, and you've got very good flow up top. Yeah.
And that's where that 30% diameter versus 50% area, maybe that's an additional impact on the patient who also has severe reflux and/or obstruction of femoral popliteal, and their venous hypertension now is not as
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay, fourth question. So my patient, who else was on that list? Let's see here. Look out in the audience. Who are the other two sites? We had, Gunderson was on there, right? I don't think that doctor, yeah. And then who is the fifth? We should remember this. Okay. What is that? Oh, crap. All right. All right, but we'll just run through quickly anyway. So patient is otherwise eligible, but I just learned that he had an acute DVT episode 1 month ago. What's the best course of action? A, don't enroll the patient. B, enroll the patient now because 1 month is plenty of time to recover from an acute DVT. Three is continue the standard care, follow the patient, and enroll the patient in a couple months. D is lyse the acute clot, regroup, and then enroll the patient. E is none of the above. Yep. Bashir says C. C? Yeah, that's right. C. So you can follow the patient. Again, you know, answer B is wrong because a month is it's an exclusion, basically. You know, within 3 months is an exclusion. So C is definitely the best answer here.
Rich, can we clarify one thing? If the acute DVT is in the non-index limb, then it's okay, right?
Yes.
As long as the index limb is free of the acute DVT, then that patient can be randomized now.
Yes.
Yep. So we look at 3 months.
3 months, yeah. Which of the following should exclude a patient from the CTRAC trial? VCSS less than 8 and no ulcer, a Valaltov less than 10 and no ulcer, VCSS less than 8, Valaltov less than 10 and no ulcer on the initial screen when you first see the patient, the same after consent, or none of the above. What's that? B? But, and B, what if the VCSS is 8 or above? So the answer here is actually now in the current protocol D. And this is important to remember that the way the protocol is now written is that on the way into the study, right, what we say is you need to have essentially suspicion for PTS due to iliac vein obstruction, right? It's we're going to go through the wording in a minute here, but basically you don't have to do the measures right up front. We deliberately, before we were having you do the measures twice, and then you get disparate readings and it created all kinds of mayhem, and so we eliminated that. And so really, you can see someone that has life limitation from their post-thrombotic syndrome, review the exclusion criteria, consent them, and then you apply the measures. And if they don't meet the criteria, then you would have to exclude them. So it's really after consent in this case here. Now we're going to run through this right here. So inclusion number one, again, is you monitor severe PTS defined by, basically you have to have PTS, which we're defining as chronic venous disease more than 3 months after a DVT. And then you also have to have substantial limitation of daily activities or work capacity due to venous symptoms. So those are the inclusions. Essentially, we're saying that they have PTS, and it seems severe enough to be appropriate for the study at this point. When you go to inclusion number two, you're essentially saying, okay, the patient may be helped by stent placement. They have an iliac vein obstruction that looks like it's substantial here, or evidence of iliac vein obstruction on AirPlus and ultrasound here. I don't know, if there are any questions on the inclusions? And then exclusions. The ones that I'm going to point out here, and then I'll take questions. Again, we talked about the inflow into the ipsilateral common femoral vein. That's to some extent a subjective judgment. And you know, you're going to do an ultrasound before you randomize somebody. And you know, again, if they have something going on down in their popliteal vein, but the veins recanalize, and when you get up to the upper segment, you're getting good flow into the common femoral vein, those patients can be included. But if you have a situation, and if the disease is in the common femoral, but there's an excellent tributary femoral or deep femoral to where if you just stent the common femoral, they're gonna have good inflow, that's fine as well. But if they do have disease that's in those upper segments of profunda and femoral vein, and you don't have a good looking upper femoral or deep femoral vein, those patients would need to be excluded because we think that they're gonna have a lot lower patencies. We mentioned the absence of PTS of at least moderate severity. And again, if they don't, you know, if you think they have PTS of moderate severity based on their activity limitation, they didn't meet that criteria. So you proceed through the exclusions and you consent them. But then you do have to apply the measures. And when you apply the measures, if they don't hit the BCSS of 8 or have an ulcer or the Valalta of 10, then by definition, they have not met that criterion and you need to exclude them. So that's how the flow works now. And I think it's a little bit less interrupted than we also have you the measures just one time, you know. And then also, if there's an open venous ulcer that's very large, more than 50 centimeters squared, or it looks like it may be infected, or you can see bone or tendon, again, the primary outcome of the study is at 6 months. And so we don't really necessarily believe that these are lesions that are going to heal that quickly. They're probably going to be there for a bit longer. And so that's why that's an exclusion. But there's others here as well. And maybe I'll see if there's any questions about the exclusion criteria. Anything that people think is not clear at all? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just had a question about the inflow portion of it. So if you've included a patient in the study, and then you place the stent and then the inflow is poor, at that point you're excluding them, don't you?
No. Once a patient is randomized, they are in the study.
So then you're going to have to balloon angioplasty, do whatever you have to do to get that inflow optimized.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So in other words, if you assess before the study, you believe they do have inflow, you randomize them, they're randomized to endovascular therapy. You get in there and you realize that, okay, well, there's webs or this or there's that in the vein that we didn't notice before. Yeah, you can go ahead and angioplasty inflow veins, you know. The only thing is that we are not doing a thrombolytic study. In other words, we don't want you to be routinely thrombolysing people unless, like, if a form clot on the table, that you can lyse if you've assessed their safety profile and you make sure that they're appropriate for lysis. That's a bit of a different thing. But in terms of, it's not really a lytic study, per se. Yeah?
Just in general, to the people who've enrolled already, quick question is, how often are these people getting, like, diagnostic?
We've probably evolved over time. I'm guessing most people are probably being still assessed by cross-sectional imaging, I'm guessing, at our clinical centers. But we're trying to encourage, because we found in our site, there's a lot of people who could have been in this study that we weren't able to demonstrate that they had the iliac vein obstruction because we were using cross-sectional imaging and trying to get it all done before we put them on the table and all that. So now, in some of my patients, I am talking to them up front about the different ways we could proceed. And the ones that may be study interested, I say, well, you know, I think the best path to really get the most accurate diagnosis of your condition is going to be to do an IVUS, you know. And that can be, you know, it's a very low risk, you know. Doing that is exceedingly low risk, you know, the way that we're doing it, right? And so we go ahead and make the diagnosis. And then we're clear also, and it's not a bad thing for the patient because they know they've got it or not, and they know it conclusively. Unlike if you do a CT where you might find a problem, but you might not, right? And so they get a conclusive diagnosis, and that can be helpful to them, whether they're in the study or not in the long run. That's helpful information overall.
So, but what do you do with the patients who have already undergone lysis or undergone thrombectomy in the past? They have a history of a DVT in the femoral popliteal segment or in the iliac segment. Now these patients come back and they have ulcers. And the question is, are those enrollable patients? Now, they don't have any active DVT, but they have a history of having it, even though it was lysed.
Sure. See, lysis doesn't always work. Yeah. So I think, great point. If they've gotten stented before in the same limb, then they're out. But if they haven't been stented, even if they've been lysed, it doesn't really affect anything. They're still eligible, you know.
Because we've been very aggressive, and just our institution is incredibly aggressive about lysis and thrombectomy on these patients, and we see fewer and fewer patients who have, you know, residual thrombus there. They have histories, and then they come back with a problem, with a venous problem.
Sure, sure. Having had previous lytic therapy does not exclude them. Now, the only thing would be, if they've got a very recent acute DVT, that's different, right? You have to wait some time, you know. But having said that, no, that doesn't exclude them at all. Yeah. But a stent in that side would, yeah. Okay, great. We'll be talking more about this, I'm sure, as the day goes along. I want to move into our next talk, and I think Dr. Parpia is going to come up and talk about minimizing bias in the trial. Now, as he's doing that, I want to tell you a bit about the partnership that we've had with the McMaster University team over 15 years, and, you know, quite honestly, these are the folks that taught me how to be a clinical trialist for the most part, you know, that, and so I'm really grateful for all of their efforts on the study. Dr. Parpia is the lead biostatistician for the study. Again, Dr. Kieran's not here. Donna McCarty, she can raise her hand, is the clinical trial manager at the DCC, and then Mark Leon is the project manager at the DCC. Really just a world-class, outstanding thrombosis trial team, and so we're grateful to have worked with them. Oh, you're a tech guy. You can probably actually figure this out. He hits show and it works.
Thanks, everyone, and good morning. We're happy to be here from the DCC at McMaster. I'm Samir Parpi. I'm the lead statistician for the study. And today I'll just be talking about some of the methodological issues to reduce bias.